Jenny Slotcher's new recording, American Heritage, was first created in 2018. Its release was delayed due to the pandemic. She says this music has been on her piano for years. She's been playing it for most of her career. And now she's decided to celebrate it on this recording. It pays homage primarily to African-American composers of the 19th and early 20th century whose works laid the foundations of later forms of music like jazz, blues, and R&B. It's part of our American heritage and a big part of it. You'll hear the stories and the music on this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Mocker. Well, Jenny, I know that you have Southern roots. Can you talk a little bit about that and how it connects to your new recording or your latest recording?
Well, I was born in South Carolina, small town, Walterboro, right outside of Charleston, where a lot of my family on my father's side settled when they came from Europe. They were in New York, and then they settled in the South, finally, in Charleston. So I was born there, and I was born into a musical family. My father was a clarinetist and my mother is a pianist. They were beautifully trained, but neither professional, although my mother graduated from the Royal Conservatory with a teaching degree. She was my first teacher. So we lived in this hamlet, this lovely old hamlet, for about 7 years. And then we began to move around the South to different states because my father's business at that time took him to various places, small towns in Kentucky and Tennessee. And eventually they settled in Nashville. I spent most of my summers at music camp, either at Interlochen and finally at the Aspen Music Festival. So I did spend time away as I entered my teen years. But the South, for me, the music was evocative in many ways. And I think that it remained more so as I studied music. And I was always looking for unusual pieces to play, to program along with the classical standard repertory. And when I found the arrangements of spirituals, I found them to be just so evocative and something that people could really relate to. I like to play a lot of 20th century contemporary music too, and I knew that might be strenuous or sometimes rather strident for audiences. So by including music that they sort of knew or sounded familiar, whether it was something with a bluesy inflection or harmonies, I felt like I was drawing more of the audience in.
You self-identify as a classical nerd, and you also love many other styles of music. Can you talk about how that became your passion? You just did that a little bit in terms of how you dove into spirituals, but I know you love all styles of music.
Yeah, you know, this is interesting. I did spend a lot of time where I probably should have been in class, but across the street from the high school I went to was at that time, it was called Peabody College for Teachers, and they had a fantastic music library. And I could sneak into the stacks and just pull out music and look at this music. And I remember the first time I was in there, and I looked at the Prokofiev Sonata, the third sonata, and I looked at the Liszt Sonata, just the opening. And to me, it looked like rock and roll. It's just like, you know, very excited. But I went through a few years then, early years, maybe 14 to 15, where I really wasn't practicing, I think, as much. I wasn't enthusiastic as much. And then I heard Hina Stera, and I started listening to the contemporary Latin American composers, the rhythm, the harmonies, and it just exploded for me. I started listening to the music of Astor Piazzolla, the tangos, and just, for me, that really woke me up. It's the Spanish music. My mother, for a time, was a flamenco dancer, too. So she always played the recordings of Segovia, and I would do that on the piano. I'd be able to go to the piano, and I would make arrangements of that. So very rhythmic, evocative, and exciting. So I just it started a trend for me. But the Latin music definitely, Hina Stera, definitely got me involved in, you know, more of the music of the Caribbean and of Brazil and Argentina. And, you know, it's very exciting. I think even when I was a teenager, I was looking at Gottschalk. At that time, Gottschalk was really not that popular. He's become very popular, but he incorporated the rhythms and the harmonies of enslaved people and their descendants, the Caribbean, just, you know, it was daring harmonically and really very exciting rhythmically. So he was so ahead of his time then, and I could sense that, I could see that, because it wasn't until 50 years later, half a century later, when Dvorak was starting to incorporate American plain song. So I really like to mix it up a bit. And yeah, jazz is just fascinating to me. I mentioned the Latin music, bluegrass while I was in the South. I love that. It's hard not to be affected by all kinds of forms of music.
One of the things that is interesting about your latest recording, which is called American Heritage, is it is exploring our American roots on so many different levels. In fact, we might even say that many of us are just learning about our true American heritage in the last couple of years as we're starting to have a better understanding of anti-racism. And I know that a lot of American dance styles that we know today were originated from enslaved people. And some of those you've mentioned, those with syncopated rhythms like tango, ragtime. Can you talk a little bit more about how those styles are reflected in the music on this recording?
Yes, you know, the dances, the music of the enslaved people, and then the rhythms took the popular American dance movement by storm. You know, it influenced and inflected what the wildly popular Charleston, bebop. The Jitterbug is a direct descendant of Juba. And I on this album by Robert Nathaniel, that is the piece from his Suite in the Bottoms, and it's called Juba. Now that dance came from Africa, also from Haiti, where it was D-J-U-B-A. But the Juba dance, also known as a ham bone, which really we're talking about hand bone, because the dance is done by patting various parts of the body, stomping the feet, patting various parts of the body. And you have to remember that on the plantations, the enslaved people were not allowed instruments because the plantation owners thought that they could be sending code, secret code to each other. So they were encouraged to dance, though, because the slave owners, the plantation owners, saw that as a way of increasing productivity. But the Juba dance is, like I said, it's a direct precursor to the Jitterbug. And the dance is done by patting various parts of the body, so you get the different tonalities, the chest, the hands, the feet, stomping with the heels. And it's really the piece. One of the things I love about this album is that there's a story behind so many of the things. Like, who was Juba? Master Juba is thought to be the grandfather of modern tap dance. And he was probably the most popular solo performer of that century. And he was the very famous face of in vaudeville and in the minstrelsy. So this is kind of a dedication to Master Juba. And it's a fabulous piece. That's one of the things. You also hear stride piano in some parts of the Burley piece from the Southland. And this music also was a direct precursor to ragtime. And the cakewalk, the third of the set of dances and the cane breaks. That cakewalk is a direct, you know, precursor to ragtime. And the other thing I like is that some of my younger friends who maybe aren't that interested in classical music because they think it's boring, they really like this album because they're hearing some blues, right? They're hearing some of the, you know, the jazzy things, and there's gospel piano, but certainly the dance forms are very striking.
This recording tells a story about our country, and it's not an easy one to hear. And I would really like if you could talk a little bit about how this music reflects everything from the Civil War to civil rights.
Well, you know, when I started to conceptualize this recording, my friends and family had long encouraged me to make a recording of some of the American music I play, because I play so much of it. And I had a group of pieces, three of them, and I called them my Holy Water Trinity. So it was the Deep River, then the Troubled Water, and finally Down by the Riverside. So that, to me, is a whole story. The Deep River, you know, crossing Jordan, in many ways that could be escaping, getting out of their misery and pain, but it could also be finally going to heaven and leaving all of that suffering. Troubled Water. With the veiled references to stream beds. And how to avoid the blood hands for enslaved people who might be escaping. The Down by the Riverside, you know, that existed before the Civil War, but it wasn't published until 1918. And that piece became synonymous with the message of freedom in the civil rights movement. You know, when the African-American people retrieved their heritage of the spiritual from the distortions of minstrelsy and vaudeville, they had a powerful genre in which to cultivate a singular aesthetic. And by the expression of this great art form, they gave voice to a young generation of African-American artists, and those pieces eventually became synonymous with message of freedom. So it spans all of that time frame. And besides our rich history of the indigenous music of the North American Indians, this is our greatest body of American folkloric music. And it arrived here with the first enslaved people. And it infiltrated all of our music. I thought this was fascinating to see how classical composers of art music, would integrate this into, you know, classical forms and then send it out around the world where, you know, the European audiences were hearing the songs of these great artists, the art songs. And, you know, yes, it does tell a story, but I really hadn't thought of it as that until I learned that Shenandoah and Suwannee River and what most people think is Camp Town Races at the end of the banjo were not American folk songs, but they originated on the great African rivers as shanty songs. And from 1820 to 1860, when the clipper ships left Baltimore, they had what they called checkered crews. So they were black and white crews. And that's where the white sailors and dock workers learned these songs. And it just fascinated me. And I realized everything on the album, with the exception of the Union, came here or transformed itself in some way or another from the enslaved people. And that's when I became aware that it was all our heritage, not just a great album of American music, but it all came to us from there.
The version of Shenandoah on this recording, which is a traditional folk song, was arranged by you and Keith Jarrett. Are the two of you friends, colleagues? How did that come about?
Well, I'm a known fan of his from early years. I heard, like many people, many classical musicians heard the Cohn concert, and it just changed my world hearing that. And so oh, we're not friends, but I'm a known fan. And I always loved that piece. And his performance of it was so moving, stark, just simple, and you know, very profound. You know, and as a child, I always learned pieces off of a recording. I was a lazy reader. So I learned that on my piano. And I wrote the notes out shorthand. And I started to improvise on it and build it out, a la my work with the Busoni transcriptions and the art of transcription, which Busoni has a beautiful treatise on. So octave doublings. Octave displacement. I added voices, ornamentation, and I built it out. And each time I sat down to play it, I would improvise something different. And finally, I realized if it was going into a recording, I kind of had to settle down on something because, you know, you have to take the best performance and, you know, maybe you have to do some editing. But I continued to fool around with it. And that's how that came about. I was just so inspired by his work. And so that's the story of the Shenandoah, which was originally Shenador, which was a windlass shanty. And Shenador, I mean, I never knew that. Just like Suwannee River, I never knew that was, you know, Mobile River. That was a Mississippi capstan shanty. So there are books written about these shanties that are fascinating. And how much of what we thought were Stephen Foster, traditional, you know, our favorite American songs were actually, you know, they came from somewhere else. And I'm happy to give credit.
It was interesting to me, too, how Dvorak came up more than once in the stories behind these composers, because he came to America and he was encouraging composers to write music that was based on their own roots. Can you talk a little bit about that and the composers highlighted on this recording who were inspired by him?
Yes. Well, we mentioned Robert Nathaniel Dett. He heard a Dvorak quartet, and he has a beautiful quote there where, after, at long last, I heard the distant voice of my long-departed grandmother, I'm paraphrasing, and that she sang of so much woe and, you know, it was a beautiful quote, but the young people then did not want to hear this music because it reminded them of the pain that their parents and grandparents suffered. Harry Burley is a walking encyclopedia of American history. He touched on so many aspects, even on the desegregation of churches here, which is a fascinating story about him. And he learned these songs from his grandfather, who was blind. Hamilton Waters was the town crier and the lamplighter. The young Harry would accompany and lead his grandfather on the morning rounds. And his grandfather was an excellent singer. And he also lived right near the piers and the water, Erie. So he learned these songs as a young boy. And he had this tremendously gorgeous voice, even without formal training. He was already singing professionally in churches and synagogues there. It was Frances McDowell, the mother of the great composer, who got him an introduction to the National Conservatory here in New York. And he became Dvorak's copyist. And he had attended business school, which is another important note about Harry Burley. He had business school before he moved to New York, where he learned copying and everything that would lead him in an entirely different career with the venerable firm of Ricordi as a copyist later in life, as a senior editor, that he was able to nurture the careers of young Black musicians. But back when he came to Dvorak, yes, Dvorak encouraged him that he should use this music. Dvorak would get tired after dinner, and he would invite Burley to sing those songs to him. And Burley said they weren't known as spirituals then. They were just, you know, folk. They were just songs. And Burley wanted American composers to do what he did for the Bohemian and Czech songs, what Brahms did for the Hungarian, what Grieg did for the Norwegian. He wanted them to make this music, to take it and make it, put it into firm structures that would convey its essence. So Burley did. and also Florence Price, her symphony, her first symphony, was inspired by Dvorak's New World Symphony, the Ninth. And that was the first, she was considered the first Black female symphonist. So yeah, Dvorak influenced a lot of these artists.
The Suite by Harry Burley from the Southland, which is featured on this recording, is his only solo piano work, and he dedicated it to Samuel Coleridge Taylor, who's also on this recording, which shouldn't surprise me, but I guess in a way it does, especially because Coleridge Taylor died at the age of 37. So he didn't have a long time to impact people, but obviously he did. Can you talk a little bit about both of those, that piece, the suite that Burley wrote, and then also what we hear from Samuel Coleridge Taylor?
Well, Samuel Coleridge Taylor was probably the greatest preservationist and cultivator of the spirituals. In order to thank him for all he did, the Americans formed the Coleridge Taylor Society, which brought him over for three tours here. In terms of Harry Burley, he was a staunch supporter of Coleridge Taylor. And it was common for these artists, when they went to London, they all did a pilgrimage to him. The writers of the Harlem Renaissance, the poets. So from the Southland, it's remarkable that that's the only piano piece by Burley. I wanted to play it for many years, and I read it all the time. I felt like it was almost too intimate and personal to take it to a big concert stage. I was waiting for one of the contestants in the piano competition I judged to play it, but you know, it wasn't this big, impressive work. They always chose something else. But the score, when you look at it, belies the real difficulty of this piece because it's so nuanced. There's so many expressive markings. And it sounds like it is so steeped in the Southern voice. It sounds like you know this melody, but there are only a few instances here where an actual melody appears. You know, there's a little quote of Swanee River. The last movement has "O Lord, What a Morning." A new hiding place. We've got little glimmers of Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. But really, it's all original music. And it's just, to me, a stunning work, a very important work. And I wished he'd written more for the piano. He wrote, it fits the hands beautifully. And in terms of Coleridge Taylor, he came here for the first tour to the homeland of a father he never knew, because his father left before he was born and went back to Africa. And he came here and he just produced these three volumes of spirituals. He felt like this, he had to do this. What Brahms had done for the Hungarian songs, he wanted to do, and he made no apology for the fact that he had arranged them, filled out the harmonies from this simple couple of lines of writing, and it's rich, they're beautiful. I've had them on my piano for so many years I can't remember. It's just favorite things to revisit and read, and they're beautifully written, and I think, you know, pianists should include them more in concerts, the way vocalists learned and adapted, including, you know, a group of spirituals at the end of their concerts. And that became, you know, quite a habit of the great artists, Marian Anderson and you know, Robeson. So, yeah, I think they're just beautiful pieces. And Deep River is certainly, was Coleridge Taylor's favorite work out of the collection that he did.
One of the things that struck me about this recording as I listened to it, literally from start to finish, I just put it on, is on the surface, the music is familiar. Many of us have grown up with these songs in one way or another. Yet I doubt very much that we know the true meaning behind the pieces. And that's one of the things that I love about the notes that you've included. You've really given us this wonderful history lesson, if you will. And one example is Troubled Water, based on Wade in the Water by Margaret Bonds. You've talked a little bit about that story. Can you talk a little bit about how she reflects that musically?
Yes, it's amazing the kind of tone painting she does at the piano. I have to say, that's another piece I had on my piano for a long time, and I played it. I didn't, you know, I studied with a great maestro, Hernan Diaz, and he loved the fact that I brought music to him that maybe nobody else was doing. But I didn't want to take this piece to anyone. It was like I wanted to keep it for myself until it was a difficult nut to crack. She was a massive virtuoso. Margaret Bonds could play anything, and she had a huge career as a concert pianist, and big hands. It's reflected in the writing. And so this piece is based on the spiritual Wade in the Water. I mentioned a thing about the spiritual was thought to contain these references to help the people who were fleeing. It's also strongly associated with the Underground Railroad, this piece. And one of the lines in the spiritual, God's going to trouble the water, refers to a verse in the Bible of the Israelites fleeing Egypt in the book of Exodus, that every now and then an angel of the Lord would come down and ruffle the water and trouble it. And the first person in after that would be healed of any disease. So it's also a piece about healing, which it's very touching. It's very touching because we hear in it also the struggle. We hear a lot of struggle, and we hear a lot of there's a current underneath that's definitely not peaceful. Part of it has a peaceful interlude, and it's very jazz inflected. Do hear that trouble sound, and initially I thought it was, you know, the pain and the suffering, and I'm sure to a certain degree it is, but then when I recognized the Bible reference, I thought, wait a second, because she was so into the Bible, very devout. I know that about her, and she was such a, you know, she had such a social concept. She started so many, you know, social services here in the city. She died at 59 too, so she didn't have a long. But yeah, that piece was very special to me, and I'm so glad that it ended up on the album.
In listening to you talk about the music on this recording and the process you underwent to put it together, I can really hear the passion in your voice. And I'm wondering what you might have discovered about yourself as you were putting this recording together. Maybe it's something that even surprised you.
Well, let's see. It's difficult to say because I've lived with the music. There's not a new piece for me here. It was a long process of putting it together and really feeling comfortable that I had everything where I wanted it to be. And I'm sure that for all the musicians out there, they know that it's never exactly where you want it to be. You're always moving the goalpost further. But I'm a very emotional person. And I think what surprised me was that I could maintain that level of emotional connection with this music after so long that never dissipated. And sometimes that does happen. You live with the piece for a long time, and, you know, you're ready to move on. You might go back and revisit that as an old friend, and you love it. Maybe you love it more. But throughout the time I was working on this music and putting it together, I get emotional when I think about the music. And I, especially after what's happened these past few years, too. I recorded this in 2018. And then the producer had this, you know, long involved, uh, my great producer, Philip, long-involved tours of China and big orchestras in London. And this was a small project in terms of the big orchestral project. So, and then other things got in the way, and he didn't get to it until the end, December of 2019. So, I mean, and then, of course, the pandemic happened. But yeah, I maintained a very strong emotional connection to this music, and it's never changed. I've never gotten tired of any of these pieces, and some pieces I've just had to put down, but not this music.
I was wondering, since you just told me it was recorded in 2018, it almost feels a little prophetic based on what's happened since then, since the death of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter. Has the music changed in any way in your mind in terms of its meaning? How do you feel about the music now compared to when you recorded in 2018, I guess, is what the real question is.
The same. I mean, the same, because, you know, the pain is always going to be there, the knowing where this music came from. And, you know, I have to go back to that history. You have to read about it. You have to understand it. Only now people are hearing more about it. They're struggling with these concepts more and more and more, which is good. But these things have been happening all along, you know. And I know that. We know that. We've all seen that. But then all of a sudden, there's the video in front of us. There's the people capturing this more and more. But it has, the music will not change. You know, the music is that way. It's self-contained in its own, you know, amazing, phenomenal universe, emotional universe.
To Jenny Slotcheva with her new recording, American Heritage. If you're enjoying new classical tracks, the best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it, help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Also, since you're clearly a music fan, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, the Piano Puzzler Podcast. Each week, host Fred Child invites composer Bruce Adolf into the studio, and they play a brilliant musical mind game as Bruce takes a familiar tune and disguises it in the style of a classical composer. Then a contestant calls in to try to solve the riddle. You can subscribe to the Piano Puzzler wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with thanks to Valerie Kaler, our producer. I'm Julie Amacher.